The Lara Murphy Show, episode 67.
Welcome to The Lara Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Lara Murphy Show. I am one half of your hosts, Bob Murphy. With me, as usual, is Carlos Lara from Nashville. Carlos, how's it going?
Everything's going good, Bob.
You know, I've been up north for a while. I was up there for the polar vortex when it was incredibly cold up near Chicago. And I thought, oh, I'm going to come down back to Texas and where it's nice, warm weather. And it's been like in the 20s and 30s here. I don't understand what's going on.
Well, last time we spoke, I mean, you were talking snow. I was talking rain. Now I'm still talking rain. We've had more rain in Nashville than I can ever remember ever having. I mean, it's incredible how much rain we're getting. And the forecast says we're getting still more rain for the next couple of days.
I was in Nashville when there was the flood. Like, my guy in my church's house was going down. It was a mobile home, folks, but I'm not exaggerating. It was on the 6 o'clock news when Nashville flooded several years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of looking that way again.
Well, I hope it stops raining then, I guess.
I do too.
Is the moral. Well, speaking of cataclysmic events, why don't we talk about the economy? when it rains, it pours.
That's a good subject.
So, folks, we are coming off of the Nelson Nash Institute. As you know, we have the practitioner program and we have the annual think tank for the IBC professional. And we just had that recently. It was a great event. And what we're going to talk about is largely the presentation I gave there. I'm going to summarize some of it. And it's also what I'm writing up for this month's issue. So we're recording this in February 2019, this month's issue of the Lara Murphy Report. So if you like the kind of stuff you're going to hear on this particular episode of the Lara Murphy Show, I strongly encourage you to subscribe to the LMR. Really don't know why you guys haven't pulled the trigger, if that's describing you. So we'll give you just some of the highlights here and just to kind of talk about where the Federal Reserve is in terms of Austrian business cycle theory and the things to look out for. So let me just sort of set the table here a little bit. Obviously, again, in the Austrian framework, the business cycle is caused by interest rates being pushed artificially low, either by the banking system in general or in modern times now, the central bank drives that. They flood the markets with artificial credit that pushes rates low. That gives a false signal to businesses. They start long-term projects for which there's not adequate real savings. And that gives the rise to the artificial boom. And everything seems great, but it's, you know, rests on quicksand. And then for various reasons, the central bank chickens out, the banks tighten up, interest rates rise, and there's a crash. So that's the basic standard Austrian story that Mises and Hayek developed. And the question is, okay, where are we in that cycle now? And again, there'll be more specifics for those of you who subscribe to the LMR. I'll be able to give it to you in more detail there in this month's issue. But big picture is the Fed has been tightening, but there's two different ways they've been tightening. One way is through rate hikes, which is in terms of standard textbook theory. That's, oh yeah, when the central bank tightens, it jacks up interest rates. And the problem, though, is, or the complication is that on this particular cycle, when the Fed started raising rates, and this was back in, December 2015, I think. It was like it was 7 years to the month after the rates had hit zero after the financial crisis hit. The Fed's been raising rates, and people could say, well, gee, you know, the Fed's been raising rates and the economy didn't fall off a cliff. And partly I think that's because the way this time around the Fed raises rates, they weren't sucking money out of the system, right? So in terms of textbook, you read about open market operations and how does the Federal Reserve work if you're teaching it like at an intro macro class to college students. The normal story is, oh, the Fed, if it wants to raise interest rates, sells bonds off of its balance sheet and then that sucks dollars out of the system. And then because now there's fewer reserves in the system, that raises the price of lending reserves overnight, and that's what the federal funds interest rate is. It's the price that banks charge each other for overnight loans of reserves. So again, the amount of reserves in the financial system is not some independent number. It's based on what the Fed's done. If the Fed buys assets, it creates reserves electronically out of thin air, and then, you know, somebody in the system holds them. So the total amount of reserves goes up. And likewise, on the back end, if the Fed's selling off assets, it's absorbing reserves out of the system, and they just disappear in an accounting sense. So the total amount of dollar reserves in the world goes down when the Fed sells assets. Okay, so that's, you know, like the weird accounting of fiat money central banks. But for our purposes, my point is that's normally how they would raise and lower interest rates. But that link has been broken this cycle because the Fed in the, October of 2008 started this policy of paying interest on reserves. So that was a brand new policy they instituted the month after the crisis struck with Lehman and AIG. And so what ends up happening, make a long story short, is when the Fed started raising rates, they weren't selling off assets. If you look at charts, and again, folks, this will be in my article in this issue of the Laura Murphy Report. If you look at a chart of Fed assets that also contains the interest rate, you'll see that interest rates started rising even while the Fed was holding its assets constant. It was just rolling over the bonds as they matured. And so that's showing you that, you know, this linkage that's normally there had been divorced, had been broken, and the Fed's raising interest rates even while it's not selling off assets. Now, in contrast, in late 2017, the Fed really did start selling off assets, or more accurately, as some of the bonds on its portfolio matured, they didn't roll over the full amount, right? So people would be paying back the principal on bonds and mortgage-backed securities and treasuries that the Fed held, and then the Fed began only rolling over a portion of that, so such that month to month, the total assets held by the Federal Reserve banks started dropping. And so that process kicked in late 2017 and then really got going strong in 2018. And so that, if you think back, that's precisely when the stock market started having those big, you know, it was really volatile, and then over time, you know, was significantly on a downward trend. And that's when people were really concerned and telling Powell, hey, maybe you need to change course and so on. So that's what's going on here. It's two different types of tightening. And it was when the Fed started letting its assets roll off. And so that process sucks money out of the system, right? As the Fed's balance sheet shrinks, that corresponds to, in a very real sense, dollars being destroyed. And so it's not a crazy nut job theory to say, hey, when the Fed's destroying dollars, maybe you're going to see stock prices falling. And on the back end, remember, when the Fed was doing all the QE, as we've pointed out many times on this show, that's what was pushing up stock prices. And the Fed was literally creating dollars out of thin air electronically and injecting them in the financial sector. So if stock prices rise because of that, you know, the Austrian school is saying that's not the source of genuine prosperity. That's a false boom. So that's kind of where we are in terms of what's going on with the mechanics of Fed policy in the court and the relationship to the stock market. So I'll stop there, Carlos. Do you want to comment on any of that?
I probably would want to say that the episode before this one, episode 66, we did cover a lot of this ground, and it might be a good idea to go back over and listen to that one as you're listening to this one too. You answered a very important question that I was asking you in 66, episode 66, and that is this payment of interest to the banks was getting pretty large, pretty excessive, because when they first started paying that interest, it wasn't paying it on that much extra excess reserves. But since they flooded the system with all these assets, all of a sudden, the Federal Reserve is paying a lot more in interest as the interest rate is going up. And so there was a real need to reduce those assets. And so here comes the rate hikes, and everybody's balking about the rate hikes. Even President Trump is going around talking that he may even fire Powell for raising rates, because it was creating, all kinds of volatility in the markets. But the idea of reducing the balance sheet, you know, that announcement was made well over a year ago that this is what they would be doing, that they would be allowing those assets to, you know, roll off the balance sheet, and that that process would take something like 5 years to do. And the Fed chair at the time, which was Yellen, was saying that there's nothing to even pay any attention there. It'd be like watching paint dry on the wall. And so all of this had started already back in 2017. And it was all happening there in the background, and no one seemed to be paying much attention to it. But then all of a sudden, the markets did react to that in the last few months, ending 2018. They reacted so violently that Federal Reserve Chairman Powell, you know, came out early in January and began to speak with a different tone about the rate hikes, and even began to allude to perhaps a new plan for, you know, reducing the Fed's balance sheet. So as we're speaking today, this is more or less what's on the mind of everybody, is that what's going to happen about rate hikes in the future? And obviously now everybody has tuned in to the fact that the reduction of the Fed's balance sheet, you know, it is creating a problem. It has actually spooked the markets, a combination of rising rates and the reduction of the balance sheet. So in effect, these are the constraints now that we're seeing very vividly. And of course, investors in particular are just, you know, very watchful, very poised to try to understand where the Fed is going next. Now, Bob and I have been saying all along that I'm not sure they even know what they're going to do next in reality, because when they started QE 1, 2, and 3, I mean, they were deliberately, you know, pumping up assets to create what Bernanke referred to as that wealth effect. Coming out of the 2008 financial crisis, the economy is depressed. And so there was a need to stimulate, if in no other way, just an attitude of things being good and fixing themselves by a rising assets, in particular the stock market and the real estate market. And of course, this is what we've seen, and it was all boosted along with pushing down the interest rates, as Bob says, down to zero, and the Fed buying an enormous amount of assets at $85 billion a clip. So they've stacked up all these assets now, and the approach they were taking now is to reduce that balance sheet, get those assets off. Obviously, paying banks on the excess reserve is getting heavy. And so we conclude, again, with the same sort of thing, that this QE 1, 2, and 3 and has done nothing more than created a situation where the next financial crisis is going to be worse than ever. And so over and over and again, we've been saying that what the Fed has really done here is painted itself into a corner. How are they going to get out of this without roiling the markets to the point that they crash severely and send to panic? So I guess that's my way of summing up where we are with the Fed and the new route they're talking about taking, Bob.
Yeah, and just to underscore one of those points, because again, I know this stuff is tricky, and it's easier if you're watching me give a PowerPoint presentation or you'll be in the issue of the LMR. But the reason the Fed is – they're not magic, right? And part of the issue is that, yes, it's a clever trick where, oh, we can pay interest on reserves, and that's the way we can, you know, hike rates without selling off assets. So let me just make sure I'm not losing people. What they're doing mechanically, like what's the actual operation, is the Fed is saying to banks, hey, if you keep your reserves parked with us rather than lending them out to their customers, we will pay you interest on that. So they inaugurated that policy again in October of 2008. In the beginning, it was really modest. It was like 25 basis points, something like that. But as the Fed has been raising its target for the federal funds rate, which is, again, the overnight loan of reserves for banks among each other, to get that rate up, what the Fed has been doing, since it didn't want to sell off assets initially and shrink the amount of reserves in the system, is it was raising the amount that the Fed itself was paying to the banks. And so right now, that's at 2.4%, right? So again, it started out at 25 basis points, which is 0.25%, and now it's up to 2.4%. And so the logic is, if you're a bank and you know you can just keep your reserves, it's like a regular commercial bank's checking account at the Fed, right? So the regular banks themselves bank at the Fed, if that's the way you want to think about it. And so if the Fed is paying 2.4% on an annualized rate for checking accounts held with it, if that's the way you want to think about it, then you as a regular commercial, but you know, Citibank or whatever, someone applies to borrow money from you, well, you would be stupid to lend it out at anything less than 2.4% because a regular person in the public might default, whereas the Fed can just create more money if it has to. So, you know, the Fed is a much safer place from an individual commercial bank's point of view to keep money parked at than to lend it out to a regular person or a business. And so by the Fed now saying 2.4% is how much it pays is interest on reserves, that's a floor that then means any other interest rate being charged by the regular commercial banks must be higher than that because, again, they can be earned a quote guaranteed basically 2.4% of the Fed. So that's the way it's working, and that's the way – so again, if the Fed wants to raise rates, it doesn't need to mess with its balance sheet. It can just bump up the amount it's paying the banks to keep the reserves parked at the Fed. So the problem, though, is that, you know, that's not like magic. It's not like a costless thing because – that means that, you know, the Fed is still having to pay that money. And so in terms of just the accounting of it, like right now, even though bank reserves are down significantly from how much, you know, the peak that they hit, I'm just looking at a chart here, looks like about mid-2014 or late 2014, total bank reserves, meaning all the commercial banks, if you added up their checking account balances held at the Fed, it also includes like literal currency in the vault, I think is in this number. But those reserves, what qualifies as bank reserves, that number peaked out at about 2.8 trillion back in, looks like around late 2014, early 2015. And now it's down to 1.6 trillion. Okay, so it's down, what, 1.2 trillion in the last 4 years or so. So that's a big drop. And by the way, just for people to have a frame of reference, before the financial crisis, this number we're talking about was like in the tens of billions. It's so low on the chart, I can barely see it because it's like hugging the x-axis. Okay, so I was saying this number, I realize people don't have a frame of reference. They don't know how big these numbers are. This was a very tiny amount because normally commercial banks don't want to keep reserves. Normally, before the Fed was paying interest, that was just money doing nothing for them. They wanted to make loans pyramided on top of those reserves so that, because that's where they were earning their interest, was from the public, you know, businesses and whatever, taking out loans and paying interest to the banks because the Fed was paying zero up until October of 2008. And then from that point forward, the amount of reserves in the system exploded because of QE and all that. And then the banks also were keeping the stuff parked at the Fed. So again, it went from being a very low amount, such that I can't even really read it on the graph here because it's getting squished down by the, you know, by the axes, up to about 2.8 trillion. And then now it's down to about 1.6 trillion. But still, just doing the math, 1.6 trillion of bank reserves right now that are earning 2.4% on an annualized basis from the Fed works out to about $39 billion in interest payments that the Federal Reserve is paying commercial banks. Okay, so that, I mean, that's real money. That's money that's not being remitted to the Treasury, right? Because the Fed is earning income off of its assets, right? The Fed bought mortgage-backed securities and treasuries. So the Fed as a financial entity is earning interest. But out of that now, it's got a, right now, at a rate of $39 billion a year, is diverting some of that as payment to the banks. So the point is, as they raise interest rates, if the Fed had not been selling off assets, well, then the amount of reserves in the system would still be a gigantic number. And so as they kept raising rates, the amount of interest they had to pay would keep going up. So that's why that's one of the elements by which the Fed's painted itself into a corner they need to be shrinking the total amount of reserves if they're going to keep raising rates, put it that way, because otherwise, again, it just gets so expensive that's part of the issue of what's going on here. So that's one element of it. Another thing, because again, you might just say, well, gee, why can't the Fed just not raise rates ever? Or why just not sell off assets? If you guys are saying that's what's causing the volatility in the markets, why doesn't the Fed just stop? And so I'm trying to show you that there are some limits as to what it can do. Another thing, too, is just regular price inflation, which over time has been rising back to conventional levels. And so if that kept going up, that would be another constraint where the Fed just couldn't keep that money sloshing around indefinitely because eventually prices would start responding. Also, unemployment is at fairly low levels. So again, I think part of the issue is when Bernanke inaugurated all these QE programs, if the Bank of Zimbabwe had done that or some South American government had done that, I think investors would have turned on them immediately. You know, their currency would have crashed in the foreign exchange markets. The yields on their government debt would have skyrocketed and so on. That didn't happen in the United States. And people like me and Peter Schiff, you know, look silly for a bit because, you know, we were kind of warning about, uh-oh, get ready, everybody. This is bad. And then, you told us that there's going to be hyperinflation. And so the explanation in the short term, like what's the immediate thing, is that investors trusted that the Fed wasn't crazy. They said, yeah, they're creating trillions of dollars out of thin air and pumping in the financial sector. But the people running the Fed know what they're doing. They saw the problem of inflation in the 70s. So we trust them. And Bernanke's going on 60 Minutes and assuring everybody, don't worry. If anything started, if inflation started rearing its ugly head, we would turn it around in a second. He snapped his fingers. So my point is, as regular measures of price inflation are rising and unemployment's back down to low levels, the Fed really can't just not do anything. It needs to tighten to show investors we weren't bluffing, that we really meant it. We injected all this money because there was the Great Recession and the financial crisis, and now that things are back to normal, we're going to suck a lot of this money out. And if they don't do that, then I think people could be alarmed and say, whoa, maybe we should short the dollar now. All right, so that's an element there too. It's hard to quantify because it's psychological, but my point is that part of how the Fed, I think, got away with the massive monetary inflation that it engaged in from 2008 onward without gasoline going up to $6 a gallon and stuff like that, is that investors thought this is a temporary injection. They're going to unwind this when the crisis is over. And so I think the Fed has to at least go through the motions and make it look like, oh, yes, we really are doing that. Don't worry. We're going to vacuum out a lot of this excess liquidity. So given that framework, Carlos, can you just talk a little bit more? Because I didn't have as much time to look at it, but I know you've been following more closely. The Fed, like with the recent minutes and so forth, did they give an actual timetable to say, yeah, we are going to stop this bond roll-off program and give a date?
Well, they did, and I do want to mention that because that was a significant change. You know, before I get into that, it was something that I wanted to add to. You know, when they start paying the banks an interest not to lend that money out, I don't think the Fed counted on this happening, but it opened the door for a lot of shadow banks to come into the marketplace. And, you know, these guys were being able to borrow big blocks of money at very low interest rates, and then they themselves entered the lending market in the big, big way. And a lot of these guys have been, these firms have been lending to people wanting either to buy homes or to buy cars. And they're not paying attention to the credit scores like the banks are. You know, the banks, because they're getting paid interest, you know, only want to deal with, you know, prime customers. But these shadow banks, they're doing a lot of the subprime lending big time. But the thing about these guys is they securitize everything and they roll it up into, package it into bonds, and they sell it to investors. And a lot of these packaged instruments of debt is winding up in investments such as mutual funds, and they're being sold off to even people across the seas or pension funds, you know, anybody that would get into those kind of investments. And not only that, you know, when you take medication, you get these side effects. You know, we refer to what the Fed does as creating malinvestments. And there's been a lot of malinvestments that have been created just simply by what the Fed has already done. And you know, one of those things was, like I said, these packaged bonds winding up in mutual funds that had, you know, some real risky features to it, as well as creating the junk bond platform to rise again. And so in the latter months of 2018, a lot of these things started really being sold off. And so the markets were getting so spooked there at the end that a lot of these things were being, you know, sold off in record numbers. And so once again, saying that the Fed is being much more cautious now on how they word the language in these minutes and also when they speak. Now, if you care to look at it, you can find the minutes on the Board of Governors Federal Reserve website. Obviously, it's a very lengthy document. This is from the Open Market Committee meeting that took place in the latter part of January, but it was just published this past Wednesday. So this is the newest information coming out from the committee. One of the things I noticed, Bob, is it's amazing how many people are on this committee. I didn't have time to actually count all the names, but there's got to be over 100 people, and they call them participants, that are involved in making these Fed decisions. So there's a lot of people that are involved in the decision-making on the—
Well, that means they must get it right then. You got so many people contributing.
But
wisdom of crowds.
I was just thinking, oh my gosh, there's several pages here that's just naming all the people that are involved here, and they're all economists on top of that. But, you know, just trying to read these minutes is like decoding a secret document. Honestly, I don't know. They're hard to read. You have to read it and reread it again to try to figure out what are they saying, you know. And there's a couple of things that did stand out for me. First of all, there's no verbiage in there of any kind of cutting interest rates. You know, nothing like cutting the interest rate from where they are. There is verbiage regarding increasing the interest rates. And the language, exactly the way it says it, is if you'll remember here recently, the Fed started using the word being patient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were going to be patient, you know, with the increasing interest rates. But it quotes saying, many participants observed that if uncertainty abated, the committee would need to reassess the characterization of monetary policy as, quote, patient, and might then use different statement language. So in other words, it's like saying that, yes, we're being patient now, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we will not continue to increase interest
rates.
What
was the trigger? It said if uncertainty is abated.
Abated, exactly. Now, I think what they're referring to is—
It takes 100 economists to come up with such a convoluted, obscure statement.
Yeah, so in other words, you know, what happened in late, you know, December even rattled the Fed, you see, is what I'm getting at. But they're on course to do what they're going to do because, as we keep saying, they have to. They have to. Now, mm-hmm. as you keep reading, another thing that pops out, it says several other participants indicated that if the economy evolved as they expected, they would view it as appropriate to raise the target range for the federal funds rate later this year. So, in a way, it's kind of hinting at the fact that probably by— as we move into the year, there's going to be a decision made on continuing to increase interest rates. As far as the balance sheet and what they plan to do, that it's not changed. They're going to continue to do what they're doing there, and that is they're going to let $50 billion per month roll off of that. So they're not necessarily changing that right now.
But can I ask you, and maybe I don't know if they've spelled it out, but I didn't have time to look at the actual minutes, but I was seeing some other people commenting on it. The thing that's difficult here is the Fed never told originally when they were talking about this roll-off program. It was like the opposite of QE3. So let me just, I know you know this, Carlos, but for the benefit of the listeners, let me just remind you. And by the way, the Fed never called it QE. That was something that the financial press dubbed these things. The Fed had some more convoluted, you know, technical term. But what everybody refers to as QE1 and QE2, those programs were closed-ended. In other words, at the beginning, the Fed said, we are going to buy this many $1 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities and treasuries at this rate, you know, and then after we do that, we'll reassess and see if we need to have more stimulus or whatever word they used. And of course, QE1 and QE2 came and went, and the economy was still in the doldrums. This is under the Obama administration at that point. And so then for QE3, the Fed, which some cynics dubbed QE Infinity, the reason for that phrase or that title was that the Fed said, okay, the reason the first two quantitative easing programs didn't really do the trick was that once investors knew what the total dollar figure was, they just priced that into the, you know, asset prices and blah, blah, blah. And so kind of just like the announcement itself was the stimulus, and then the rest of it was just cleanup operation or the, if you fill in the details. And so for this third round of quantitative easing, this is what the Fed was telling the markets, we're going to, you know, we're going to ramp it up to $85 billion a month of asset purchases mixed between mortgage-backed securities and treasuries. And we're just going to keep doing that until it works. We're just going to keep doing that until the economy's really healthy again, and then we'll start tapering it off. But in other words, they didn't commit on the front end to saying this is going to be the total buy spread out over this time frame. It was open-ended. And that's why some people were jokingly calling QE infinity, meaning the Fed in principle was committing to creating an infinite amount of dollars until it worked. So now when they're telling the markets how are they going to shrink their balance sheet, and they made this, you know, this was discussed years ago. This isn't some new thing. This is like, I don't want to say a day because I might be getting mixed up, but this was something that happened before. The Fed was giving guidance as to how are we going to start unwinding the balance sheet. You know, they gave a timetable to say how the roll-offs per month were going to accelerate up to a cap. And is it $50 billion a month, Carlos? Does that sound right to you?
That's right.
Yeah. So they were saying, we will not let our balance sheet shrink by more than $50 billion in any given month, but that's, you know, how much it might get up to in terms of the rate at which the balance sheet would shrink. But they never said what the actual end game was. They never said, and then once, you know, the balance sheet is reduced to this amount, then we're going to stop it and then things will be back to normal and that's it. They never said that. The only guidance they gave was to say something like, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was something along the lines of, we're going to significantly reduce our holdings, but even when we're done, we're going to be carrying a larger balance sheet than we did before the crisis. So they were saying, yes, we're going to sell off assets, but even when we're done with that, we're going to be holding more assets than we were, like, you know, relative to GDP or whatever, however you want to normalize it, you know, before the financial crisis hit. So forever, the Fed's going to be having more assets than it used to. But they were saying we're going to do it. So now what Powell and the other Fed officials were saying in recent months was along the lines of, you know what, you know, we're still letting these bonds roll off, but we're going to wrap that program up sooner than we had thought we would if you had asked us a year ago. So they weren't telling us what the different number is. I was joking, Carlos, that you weren't there at the Mises event I just did in Orlando. I was joking as I was saying, it's as if Powell's telling the world, I'm thinking of a number between, you know, one and a trillion, and now I just thought of a smaller number, you know, like that's the game they're playing. We don't know what the target is. We just know the target now is smaller than it used to be.
Yeah, they had indicated way back that the whole process could take up to 5 years. But yes, in these minutes, they're sort of backpedaling now. And the reason they're using, Bob, is something that you've already mentioned in this podcast, is that the excess reserves have dropped by $1.2 trillion. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there's a need for more currency in circulation, and that you have to have a certain amount of assets on the balance sheet for that currency, you know, to be balanced out. But I think that the language that I'm reading right here at the moment says the Fed is saying that some investors might have interpreted previous communications as indicated that a very high threshold would have to be met before the committee would be willing to adjust its balance sheet normalization plans. So the Fed basically took a new approach, communicating its flexibility to halt the sell-off. And so, yeah, they are saying that they are going to announce, not now, later, probably before the next time they have another meeting, exactly when they're going to stop selling off assets, and that it'll be before the year is up. So that, yes, that indicator was clearly given in the minutes.
Okay, so I guess we could use, if they were originally saying it will take 5 years, we could do the math and multiply and say, you know, $50 billion per month times 5 years, how much total could they possibly have sold off? Now, if they're still not going to go above $50 billion a month and they're going to wrap it up this year, we could sort of box in and get a, you know, an upper bound on what's the difference in what they're projecting in terms of the end carrying state of the balance sheet. But
yeah.
So yeah, I guess we could back it out that way. But again, it is funny that there was no... It's not like they originally said, we're going to end up stabilizing the balance sheet at $800 billion. And now there's like, oh, we're going to stabilize it at $1.2 trillion. There was no numbers like that. It was just, we're not going to let as many bonds roll off as we were planning before. But we technically don't know. It's just a weird
situation. Well, the minutes actually give the impression that the Fed is sort of mystified that the unwinding would spook the market the way it did.
Yeah. And... Yeah, and with this stuff too, let me just mention, it's easy to be cynical, you know, or going the other way around. Like, I know there are a lot of conspiratorial people, and I'm not, no, there's anything wrong with that, who kind of, I guess what I'm saying is to our listeners is don't make the mistake of assuming that Powell knows Austrian economics inside and out, and he's looking at the things the same way we are. And so if they're saying they're surprised that this happened, oh, they must be lying. You know, who knows how they're looking at it? My example is we had Ed Prescott here, Carlos, the Nobel Prize winning economist, you know, extremely sharp guy, gives a presentation. You know, I loved a lot of what he was doing. He's up there going through the history of macroeconomics, you know, from the mid 20th century on, and half the papers he's citing, he was a co-author of, you know what I mean? It's stuff that I had to study in grad school. And I'm like, oh geez, yeah, I forgot he was on that paper. So, I mean, really impressive guy. But he made this offhand remark. He's very bullish, given his world. And he made this offhand remark saying, so in the short term, the probability of there being a U.S. recession is 0%. He actually said that. Mm. You know, and I'm thinking, well, there could be aliens attacking. There could be an earthquake next Thursday that rips the country. You know what I mean? Like, that's just a pretty strong statement when really what he just means is, I don't see any real danger to the economy in the near term. So my point is, let, you know, people... who are not Austrians, who do not think of the, and also, Carl, I had Alex Tabarrok, guy at GMU, you know, free market libertarian, was a big fan of Murray Rothbard back in the day and stuff. And I had him on my podcast, the Bob Murphy Show. And he also doesn't, I explicitly asked him, he's not ruling out there could be a recession, but he thinks it'd be because of a future policy mistake. He doesn't think that that the Fed somehow, you know, baked in a recession and that, you know, there's no way to avoid it at this point because there's been all these malinvestments for the last 5 years. He doesn't, to him, that's not, or if there were malinvestments, he thinks it's not a big deal and that the market could overcome it as long as policy is good going forward. So I'm just saying this notion that you and I have as Austrians, that what the Fed has done has sown the seeds for a big crash. Not everybody looks at the world like that.
Right. Right. So, my summation is that we're about to hear a new plan from them that's going to be revealed here very soon, both about additional rate hikes and also the stopping of the sell-off, and it'll be done before this year is up. Now, because they're making that very clear. Now, what will investors do with that is another question. What will they do with that? How will they interpret that? Because I think most people realize that the economy really is slowing on many levels, even though while the stock market was raging and real estate prices, you know, were basically holding. But things are slowing down. And like I said last time, not just here in the United States, in other parts of the world as well. So I think it's kind of like creating a perfect storm kind of situation. The Fed's not going to be able to control the attitude of investors and how they really feel. You know, there's a sense, there's an angst in all investors right now. We've been riding on awfully high speculative kind of strategy, and this just can't keep going up all the time. You know, and I think most people are saying, I think we've ridden this thing about as hard as we can. We got to start slowly getting out of here without panicking everybody. And I think the Fed realizes that that's where the real big issue is. Will people start to cash in now, realizing that things are pretty bad? And will that happen without just panicking everybody? And that's where the real danger is, because once the panic starts, you can't stop it.
Right, yeah, and I agree with all that as well. So I guess to wrap up, what we're seeing is that the Fed is, I think they're doing what they can to try to reassure markets. And oh no, we're going to backpedal here on this aggressive sell-offs, and so I guess relative to their original policy course, maybe that postpones the day of reckoning a little bit. But ultimately, yeah, they can't avoid it. There is going to be a reckoning because of all those male investments that were made. And also there's plenty of things, you know, objective features that are boxing the Fed in. And even the other thing too, I don't think I mentioned it yet in this episode, and we're kind of low on time here, so I won't elaborate, but just looking at things like the yield curve, and this is something that will be in my article for this month's LMR, that's close to inverting, right? So there's various measures of showing, even if you're not an Austrian, that a recession is in the offing. So, I mean, what I said at the think tank was that if the Fed keeps it selling off assets the rate it's going, I think you're going to see a yield curve inversion. And I think I would be very surprised if we don't, you know, if that continues and there is a yield curve, I would be very surprised if there's not an official recession that begins either late 2019 or in 2020 at some point. I don't see how you avoid that. Again, unless, you know, they do some new round of asset. And by the way, not that that would fix the problem. If they did like QE4, all of a sudden that might push back the day of reckoning a little bit, but there still would be that, right? It would just be that much worse. But I don't think the Fed's going to do that. I think right now, like Carlos is saying, they realize they do need to be tightening. And now that they're trying to figure out a way, how can we do it without crashing everything? But I don't think right now they're thinking, oh, forget this. Let's just go ahead and buy a bunch more assets. I think there needs to be a big crash before the Fed would start another massive asset purchase, is my feeling.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, well, we're over time at this point, so why don't we wrap up there? Thanks, everyone, for your attention. Let me mention, folks, we have a relatively new feature. This actually has been in place for probably an episode or two, but let me just officially say it in case I haven't. At this point, we now have it so that there's a redirect option. So, for example, right now you're listening to the Laura Murphy Show, episode 67. If you wanted to go see the links, so we'll have links at the page, you know, to the Fed minutes, and I'll also dig up the original Fed discussion about the roll-off program. I'll link to my Bob Murphy Show interview with Alex Tabarrok, just, you know, in case you're curious, you can hear what he was talking about, where he's coming from. So for each of these Laura Murphy Show episodes, we have links discussing or, you know, giving you more information about the stuff we covered in the episode. And now there's a very easy way for you to get to it. You know, you could originally you'd have to go to the archives and find the episode and everything. But now you just go to. So if you want to hear this, oh, it's episode 67. So how do you find it? You go to lauramurphy.com/67. That's all you got to type in. And then it'll redirect you to the actual, you know, long URL for this particular episode. So that's a relatively new feature we've got in place. It's actually true for all the prior episodes, too. So that's a quick, handy way now. You can go look up Laura Murphy Show episodes by number. Thanks, everyone, for your attention, and we will see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of lauramurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.